beginning an oral history collection. And I, Daisy Newman, have been appointed to interview our resident friends, Marion and Edwin Sanders. David Freudberg, who's been advising the Oral History Committee about equipment, has kindly volunteered to do the taping. Today is April 24, 1984. It's raining. President Reagan is on his way to China, surrounded by TV cameras, and we are sitting in the Selleck room, surrounded by memories of George Selleck, who was appointed to serve this meeting for 6 months and invited to remain for 28 years. He brought to the meeting those same qualities that you do, Marion and Ed. Love, wisdom, selflessness, and devotion to friends' testimonies. We hope you too will remain with us far beyond the term of your initial appointment. Now tell us a little about your lives before you came to Cambridge, and your work here, and your vision for the future. You start, Ed.
Well, coming to Cambridge was a new experience for both of us, just in coming to New England. As we saw our period of appointment at Pender Hill drawing to a close, we had looked forward to going to some overseas appointment, and perhaps to Ireland, or at least to the British Isles. And so in family responsibilities prevented that. It seemed that New England was just the very closest thing to a foreign assignment. And in some ways it had that allure and reality for a new kind of climate, a new set of families, new set of friends meetings to enjoy and to become part of. It was a change in the kind of appointment also. We'd started out with teaching school in the days when there had a kind of an authoritarian ring for the teacher. And we moved from that into an executive secretary position with the service committee in Southern California. When we were appointed to the work at Pendle Hill, the only thing they were agreed upon most enthusiastically was that they were going to stop calling the position that I would be holding director. For that had gone to, had gone created confusion and some difference of opinion as to its usefulness. And they settled on executive clerk, which seemed to me a kind of contradiction in terms. But there we were. When we came to meeting here, the thing that everyone seemed most agreed upon was that they wanted persons who would be friends in residence. And we could make of that title about what we wanted to. How did he see it, Marion?
Oh, well, I was starting near the beginning, how we came together as a couple at Earlham College, and were given the opportunity to serve friends in Pacific College on the West Coast in Oregon.
In which year?
We met in 35, but in 39 we moved. moved out from Earl to take, or in 38-39, moved out to Oregon to take a position at Pacific College. This was in the last stages of the Depression, and we were very fortunate to have a job at all, and they felt they could get two teachers for the price of one, or half a salary for the two of us. And it was a very good beginning for our life together there. Ed taught German and literature, and I taught history of civilization and literature, and was dean of women and took over all of the speech work and the women's athletic program and a few other things. So that was the beginning. Within a few months, the Selective Service came into Oregon, and Ed had always known that he could not register for the draft, and so we were separated for part of a year, and in addition to the assignments that we both had, Ed went off to prison, and I had to take on part of his assignment. So it was a great relief when he was paroled to civilian public service camps, which were just opening then in California, and that began our stay in California. I think Ed could pick up from there, because much of the record of what we did in California is related to his work. I can tell you how our family grew a little later.
Could I just ask a question? Mm-hmm. You started at the point where you're both young adults. I wonder if you could talk about before then. And were you friends at birth? And a little bit about that background would be interesting.
I was a birthright friend. My parents were both members of meetings in Indiana. They were pastoral meetings, but their they both attended Earlham, and we felt we had a long history with friends. The Binford family, which was my father's family, had large reunions of 500 people and on big farms, and that was part of my heritage. I seemed to have been chosen by the family to represent the Quakers in our family for some reason or other. The rest of my family were business people. My father was a cement manufacturer, but somehow or other I carried on the Quaker line and was the only one who went to a Quaker school. Ed's record is similar.
Practically the same story, except it was in Wilmington Yearly Meeting in Ohio, and it was from there that I attended, grew up in that church. But when we went to Earlham, we had our first encounter with unprogrammed meetings for worship and realized that that was what we were meant for.
Yes, you were.
What do you mean? What did you find there that attracted you?
Right, I would judge that the simplest way to say it is there's a vital, recognizable, almost tangible experience of a spiritual reality, which courses throughout the universe, which one can encounter in expectant waiting for it. And that had never happened to me before.
Tell us about your experience in Africa.
Well, let's see. We have, this was during the time that we were involved with the American Trans Service Committee. I had about 20 years of being executive secretary, and so we're given 2 years of leave to do an overseas assignment. Instead of taking a service committee assignment, we asked to go to Kenya to teach in a teacher training college for the African school there, which had been under the management of the Friends United meeting and was a mission post.
It was Kamosi.
It wasn't Kamosi. It was just at the time that the government had gained its independence and had its first African administrator of the school and the first woman to ever have held a post in the under the Ministry of Education, higher than a teacher in the 6th or 7th standard, which would be our comparable to our grade school. So to work with Salome Nolega was a great experience. We thought of her often, and she just died this past 6 months.
Did you teach literature there?
Yes, we did. Our assignment was, however, to teach English, speaking the English, because the medium of education is English in East Africa at that time, and I believe it still is. While the children could have their own native tongue up to the 3rd and 4th standards, they also received English. So I was to get the teachers who were sometimes only 5 and 6 years older than the students in the village school to have some kind of recognizable pronunciation and vocabulary, although it was really not too important that we would recognize it. It was whether the children and the teachers had a working relationship of recognizing that as their English African. It was an exciting time for us both. One of our children got sick while we were there, and Marion had to come home after the first year. I was left there to finish our contract with the government.
This was which year?
That would be in
65, 67.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about your interest in literature before we get to Cambridge meeting. And you have a poem to read.
I don't know that this poem is so great, but we're using poetry. I'm using poetry more and more in workshops now as a part of the means of communication, this kind of intangible experience that is so that we have in our religious life, the mystery. Well, there's no less mystery in the origin of poetry or the origin of the painting, which you only feel its meaning and sometimes I feel that it's more helpful to see it and hear it in a poem or see it in a picture. But I was reminded just recently of this familiar, very short verse by Emily Dickinson. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies. Too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise, as lightning to the children eased with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind.
Mm-hmm. You talk a little about Blake.
We were fortunate to share together at Earlham, E. Merrill Root, the poet, a New England poet who was not only a good teacher, but he was a writing poet at the time that he was at Earlham and spent all summers in New England writing poetry. He could very soon discover that I was not a poet, but that I had a great love of literature, and so he would recommend books that I should read over the summer, and they always proved to be just the right book for me, and they became the center of the rest of my life's search. When we were able to go on to graduate school right out of Earlham, he suggested that I take William Blake as a project for a master's degree, and I wasn't able to go to the school of my choice, which was Radcliffe, because of finances and other things, but I was given the opportunity to go to Penn State, and you can imagine that William Blake was not the favorite topic of in a technical school like Penn State, but I lived next door to the head of the English department, and he allowed me to do it, provided it met his standards in writing. So I started the study of William Blake in 1939, and it has been a search of this mystery that we both know and pursue. And the wonderful part of all of this is that William Blake is more easily understood every year now because our scientific world has caught up with the intuitive understanding that William Blake had about the nature of the universe. He was he understood that good and evil are part of the same reality, and that the energy of evil is sometimes as strong as the energy of the good, and that unless one can incorporate and integrate all the aspects of one's life, one is deprived of the great energy and drive that human beings possess. And this was very foreign, of course, to either the rational approach of ethics or to the intuitive approach, and thus somehow or other one caught up with the alternate nature of the universe being the ocean of darkness and the ocean of light, and taking both of them to be the reality. Well, I studied alone, and I had no opportunity to really share my interest in Blake until Pendle Hill, and I had to talk pretty hard to get the opportunity to teach Thoreau and Blake at Pendle Hill, but it made rounding out of a lifetime private study, and I'm very grateful for that, because the discipline of trying to make something that one loves very much understood and shared by someone else is a great joy. And we were also fortunate at Pendle Hill to be very near one of the best Blake collections, private Blake collections of all the world. I could take our classes there and could handle, actually hold and look at these beautiful treasures of Blake. But now I think Blake belongs to everyone. One can understand him better and better each year.
Did I hear you right that there was initially resistance at Pendle Hill to your studying Blake and Thoreau?
Well, only because Pendle Hill is a school for study and contemplation. One would naturally think of the Bible and biblical or journals, Quaker journals, and literature. Literature was not their favorite subject, but my goal in life has been to show that they're the religious search is expressed in all kinds of creative effort, and it's the creative aspect of literature which is the divine element, I think.
Oh, I agree. And you're going to Pendle Hill this weekend to read Alan Brooks's poems? Yeah?
Yes. Pendle Hill is going to be celebrating the Jubilee, the 50th year of its publications program. That's what has produced the Pendle Hill pamphlets. And I would guess that for at least 30 of those years, Helen Morgan Brooks has been distinguished as one of the few black members of the board, but one of the most active persons, faithful persons, and able persons on the publications committee. She had taught English and literature in the schools at Scranton, Pennsylvania, and in the school system of Philadelphia. So she has a rich life and just a wonderful person. She's been quite ill, so it's time to give her all the attention that you can shower on her.
We'll now come back to Cambridge meeting and tell us how you feel about it. I know how we feel about you. You tell us how you feel about us and what you would like to see happen here. That's a big order.
Let me just say a little bit about where I found myself here and what was attractive about it, and then have Marian tell a little bit about the potential
yes.
for this kind of remarkable setting, remarkable context for the meeting to be operating in. We have been associated, as you can see, with the Society of Friends in one way or another all our life, and generally in business. We've not really been public friends in the sense of traveling around and speaking a great deal, but in holding positions of responsibility in the Society of Friends, that's been our life. The Baker Schools, didn't mention the schools in California, but that's another story. Coming here was a chance to not just be a member of a meeting, but to be in a kind of very center of a meeting, to, without being a minister or an executive person, staff person with any administrative responsibility. Yet there was a great opportunity to be in the very middle of things and to see how the meeting does operate. And doing it really unobtrusively, I hope, because we did have a usefulness just in being hosts or helping the organization of the use of the property, and whatever came up, really. They didn't want us to do anything that a member of the meeting should be doing. And that was a very helpful guide for us in many ways. Fortunately, there's a great many things that are out of place that no member of the meeting really wants to do.
So you do.
But needs doing. But I think the real future of the Friends meeting here is in what it isn't yet, what it isn't yet doing. The opportunity of having 150 to 200 people here on first day worshiping together, many of them having their very first experience of an unprogrammed meeting. Most of them not members of the meeting, but visitors or attenders whom we honor as much as we do our own members. What the future, and what is the responsibility that we have for each other? Is the matrix, which many times is uncomfortable, it's difficult, it's frustrating, and yet so many times it is so rewarding in finding persons that are telling us what the religious experience really is for them, and not reminding us, but opening up for the whole meeting depths of worship, depths of inspiration that can touch us all. But when we say, what kind of an education program should the meeting have? Or what is the right program, what is the right sharing of the meeting for worship with all the members of the family? What are we saying to each other in our lives, our lifestyles together? Or our meeting, what is the meaning of marriage in the meeting? How do we say that effectively? They're the very oldest questions, aren't they? They're the ones that friends worried with at various days. But they are our faith that we have a continuing revelation should make us ask our queried questions over and over with new answers, needing new answers. Times are changing. The meeting membership is changing.
Well, it has constantly been able to make the system work in among friends. He's been clerk of the monthly meetings. He's been longtime clerk of civic yearly meeting. And I've always been frustrated in having such a vision of the possibility of the system working, but not being able to make it work so well for me. But this has led to a constant search for the interpretation of the history and philosophy of Friends, in which I believe very strongly. And at Pendle Hill, I was asked to teach a class in Quaker process. Styles of Quaker leadership, trying to interpret for others who were not friends the Quaker process. And I found this a very exciting adventure, like interpreting a piece of literature or interpreting a philosophy of life that means a great deal to one. And I became much more aware of the genius of the system of governance and of the spirit that works in strange and mysterious ways when people come together in the silence to ask for guidance. So, in a sense, I'm continuing that search here with much of the same surprise and frustration that anything that I love so much can't fully understand enough to interpret to in a common way where I think we could deepen and get stronger and share together the new life, the emerging energy force that comes out of using the worship period effectively and extending that in face-to-face context. That deepen our relations to one another. Of course, that's an extraordinary challenge here with very few people living very close to the meeting. And most of those who live close to the meeting staying here only a short period of time and moving on, so that building of community in an urban setting is quite different and a great challenge. But I think at the heart of that is the educational process of understanding and interpreting what is going on in the query session, coming at the queries fresh so that we ask questions of deep content of one another as if we were asking those questions for the first time, or that as if we needed to discover who we are as a people in order to appreciate one another more, or understand the motivation that leads one to take up a particular lifestyle, and or how a committee functions when it has all of the limitations that we acknowledge in a big meeting like this. This is the kind of query that I puzzle about and like to wrestle with. And as we go back to Pendle Hill this next weekend and try to describe the process of discernment, of understanding the roots of Quakerism that lead to know how to do things, how to move through experiences, it seems to me that that's the heart of what has it intrigued me about this meeting, the kind of discerning of the yearning that goes on in this wonderful meeting where the worship...
Just turn that right over.
Cool. Where the worship is primary to those who come in for the first time. And I would like to be given the gift to understand the process that's going on here and to reveal it in an encouraging fashion that brings us all together in realizing the wonder and the mystery of the method that we have here. That sounds rather audacious and not very humble, but it comes from the same motivation that and thrill that one has when one reads a work of literature for the first time and understands what it is, what spirit is being conveyed by the artist to the community. And I think we need to look upon our own meeting as that kind of creative experience that we share together and interpret it.
You're talking about a life work for each of us. It's as long as we live, wherever we are.
Can I ask a couple of points? Earlier you were talking about the sense of responsibility that friends have for one another in a community. I was wondering if you could try to explain the extent of what you perceive that responsibility to be.
Well, a very moot point in the throughout the Society of Friends now is around the nature of membership in the society. What is it that attracts a person to the meeting? What expectations have been aroused in them for their own life? What changes do they want to make in their own life that are have led them to ask to become a member? What difference do they want it to make in their life? Many times this is that they have found a congenial group of people who are living a kind of life that is challenging to them, and they would like to do some of the things that they are doing, or they would like to incorporate in their own families and their own vocations ways of solving problems and making a living, whatever that may be. And they just want to do better. Maybe they like to do less better in their lives.
What do you mean, do less
better? Simplify their lives.
In a worldly way.
Yes. Focus more of their life on being more effective. Now, how do we exercise our responsibility of having invited them into a community that might be that matrix for living a new way. too often, I think, the Society of Friends has not has been careful not to make prescriptions for individuals as to what they should do or shouldn't do, which is closely related to our strong emphasis on not committing ourselves to a creed or to a statement of faith. Although we expect everyone to believe something and to be able to articulate it and to make that the basis of the compatibility which we feel is essential on the part of the meeting and the person applying to be satisfied with their taking on their responsibility. Many times, however, we don't really get to the person deeply enough to understand what it is they're really searching for. And then we may not be the people ourselves because we don't train ourselves to solve problems.
We don't have all the answers.
At least this one. It's very much like the way the scientist has a hypothesis about life. And not only has a hypothesis, but has enough experience to want to follow a certain discipline for testing his ideas. Not only testing his ideas, but to map out a program that if it does work that way, some certain result will come along. But it requires a discipline to do it. And you invite someone to help you do it. Use a staff or a few people. Maybe all the people you can get to do it. As people are with the nuclear freeze or with other political measures. But we send out the invitation, but do we set up the laboratory and do we ask enough of each other in the experiment to to produce what we could.
What's your hypothesis that you're testing?
Do you think we ought to continue?
I think we've done pretty well.
We think we've done enough. Right. We leave David hanging like that.
Yes,
it's a silent hypothesis.
Trust the silence.
We'll have to make him want to come back.
Mm-hmm. Yes, my hypothesis might be you can trust the
Oh, thank you. It was good. Does anybody want to say anything more? We don't have to stop. I think the tape's almost at an end, isn't it?
One can flip it over.
We can flip it over. Would you like to? What would you like to do?
Find a stop.
Well, thank you.
And you hope that we won't stop talking to one another.
Yeah, oh, we're not likely to. And thank you, especially David, for helping us. It was good. I'm glad I was able to be the one who could make you talk.
Thank you. Wonderful with your introduction.
Beautiful.
The rain may even be lifting a little.
Shall we turn it off?
Sure.
I'm going to do this.